On This Week in Enterprise Tech, China is behind ransomware, VR is making it into the real world, and Dr. Howells from Argyle Data is here to show you something useful with big data. It's Wyatt on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Enterprise Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 184, recorded March 21st, 2016, for April 8th, 2016. Argyle fights fraud with big data. This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by Thinkst Canary. Detect attackers or malicious insiders on your network with honeypots that can be deployed in minutes. For 10% off and a 60-day money-back guarantee, go to canary.tools/twit and use the code TWIT at checkout. And by Igloo Software. Igloo is an internet that you'll actually like. It connects people with the information they need to do their best work. Try it for free at igloosoftware.com/twit or sign up for a live demo to see it in action. Welcome to Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech. It's the show dedicated to the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and the geek who just wants to know how the world is connected. I'm your host, Father Robert Ballasair, the digital Jesuit, your guide to all things in the enterprise. But of course, I don't guide you by myself. I've got a regular cast of characters, starting with Mr. Lou Maresca. He's a senior lead at Microsoft at their incredibly popular Dynamics division. Lou, welcome back to the show.
Yeah, it's great to be back.
Now, we can't have you on without a baby watch. What's going on with the baby? What's happening? Have you slept yet?
I'm starting to sleep. And unfortunately, he's a little sick, but we're actually starting to sleep, so it's great.
No, Lulu. When a baby gets sick, you're all getting sick. That's how it works. Welcome to Fatherhood.
Siri just woke up and said, I don't understand.
Now, someone who is not dealing with a baby in the house is Mr. Curtis Franklin from Information Week Radio. Curtis, how are you over on the right coast?
Padre, I'm doing really well. Glad to be here. Spring has sprung in the swamp and, the alligators are croaking. It's a great time.
Well, gentlemen, we've got a good episode for our audience. We're going to be talking all about big data with Dr. Ian Howells from Argyle Data in just a bit. But first, let's go ahead and jump into the blips. This first one, in news that is shocking, completely shocking. Okay, totally not that shocking. Researchers from four security firms announced that many of the ransomware attacks on U.S. companies are originating from China, quite possibly with state support. Phil Burdett, head of Dell SecureWorks Incident Response Team, has been tasked with forensic analysis of three ransomware cases in which hackers were able to exploit known application server vulnerabilities to install ransomware on hundreds of computers. Burnett noticed that many of the tools and tactics being used were nearly identical to those being used by Chinese state-sponsored network intrusion cases. While this doesn't mean that the Chinese government itself is commissioning the attacks, it does suggest that at least a few of the hackers employed by the Chinese government are moonlighting to supplement their income, which could have been dramatically reduced with the announced reduction in cyber espionage by Beijing. In any case, security researchers involved have warned that as it becomes less financially sufficient to trade credit cards and identities, ransomware will become the de facto cyber smash and grab.
iMessage encryption busted, cracked, and fixed. Get excited, but not too much. A vulnerability in the encryption method used by iOS and OS X when transmitting iMessages would allow attackers to intercept messages and snoop on photos and videos, according to researchers at Johns Hopkins University. That's bad. On the other hand, the vulnerability was fixed in iOS 9.3 and updates to Mac OS X El Capitan. Using an emulated Apple iCloud server, researchers obtained links to photos stored in iCloud sent by those phones, as well as 64-digit encryption keys. According to the researchers' report, the proof-of-concept attack took roughly 130,000 edits and 72 hours.
You would think that 34 years of using a technology, especially one that's widely used by email servers, would substantially improve its security over time. Not this guy, says SMTP. While as a middle-aged as SMTP might be, this might be the midlife crisis it's been looking for. On Friday, a coalition of researchers from several tech giants as Google, Microsoft, and Yahoo have submitted a new proposal for a new email protocol called SMTP S2S, or Strict Transport Security. SMTP is inherently just plagued by security flaws since its debut in 1982, and its first attempt to fix that problem was the STAR TTLS extension that was brought in 2002. Basically encrypts the channels to send the messages. One issue with this extension was it wasn't widely adopted. And if you're an optimist, the STAR TTLS is for you because basically it uses opportunistic encryption. It doesn't actually validate anything with the digital certificate presented by an email server. It just assumes that even though the server's ID is not verified, encryption of the traffic is better than nothing. This opens the door to man-in-the-middle attacks, replacing certs with self-signed ones or spoofing opposing servers and telling the sender that its counterpart doesn't have encryption. So just unencrypt yourself and show plain text. So this one is actually the next attempt at securing SMTP. With the new extension, where it gives email providers the means to inform connection clients that TLS is available and it should be used, it also tells them how the presented certificate should be validated and what should happen if TLS connections cannot be safely negotiated. I don't know about you, but I'm ready to open any technology that might help email be more secure.
Are you the proud owner of the toughest laptop on the planet? If so, it's time to check your manufacturing model and date. If you purchased a Panasonic ToughBook CF-VZS-U61U or 1R between December 2011 and August 2013, you need to stop using your notebook immediately. A recall has been issued for the 6-cell lithium-ion battery pack because it has been discovered that a batch of their batteries were contaminated by a foreign conductive material during manufacturing. Though the recall affects less than 500 units, the fear is that the recall may expand as they check manufacturing records and sample batteries from adjacent batches.
HPE hyperconverges. Hewlett-Packard Enterprise has jumped into the hyperconvergence market with an integrated appliance built on its ProLiant DL380 server. The hyperconverged 380 is a two-node appliance that combines VMware vSphere, software-defined storage in the form of HPE Store Virtual and HP OneView User Experience Management Software. The user interface is designed to support mobile platforms, allowing users to provision and recommission VMs from their phone. Now, it's important to note that HPE is positioning the HC380 as upgradable to its composable infrastructure strategy. With the HC380, HPE can help mid-size and small organizations boost their virtualization capacities and migrate to private cloud and then hybrid cloud. As industry analyst Colm Keegan said, this is intended to be not just the end-all, be-all, but a stepping stone.
Apple debuts updates to ResearchKit and debuting CareKit. ResearchKit debuted last year. It's a set of open source libraries that allow for apps to tap into health data already being collected by iOS devices from external devices such as heart monitors, blood pressure, etc. The new updates could either be the start or end of consumer-driven or early warning systems for many well-known inherited diseases that plague our population, or the onset of massive amounts of false warnings to consumers, to health professionals, adding to the hypochondria we all have in the information age. As an optimist, this could be allow for big data to be used for good on the Earth's population in order to generate insights into the determining whether if people have specific diseases or not. It will allow researchers to collect more specific data like genetic data and perform various medical tests that are generally only conducted in exam rooms. CareKit was also debuted. This is an open source framework that allows end users to manage their medical conditions through customer care plans, symptom trackers, and many different other things. And together, these are basically the start and end of an end user's medical SOSIS warning net to bring together data points from all over, which directly impact the insights of customers.
Are you a gray hat teetering on the edge of black hat dumb? Well, good news. The world's top malware developers have been releasing their software for free as turnkey phishing kits for those with even a minimal understanding of PHP. These My First Malware kits aren't the shareware equivalent of the dark web either. Many of them have high-quality site emulation, certificate spoofing, and error redirection that can fool even savvy users. Of course, the free malware sounds like a head-scratcher until you realize that most of the kits have a backdoor that exports exploited data back to the original writer of the package. The end result? a Ponzi scheme of digital baggery that lets script kiddies run quick scams while also setting up advanced persistent threats for the malware masterminds. With more than 4,000 cyber attacks a day in 2015, a monetary damage amount that is up 400% since 2005, and an annualized loss of $28.3 million in the financial sector alone, it looks like this master Padawan arrangement is only going to become more popular. Well, that does it for the blips. Next up, we're going to be jumping into the bites. But before we do that, let's go ahead and thank the sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, a brand new sponsor, one who I'm happy to have as part of the Twiat Riot because they help you discover what's been happening in your network. And it's Canary. Now, think about this. If you're dealing with a potential breach, when you're dealing with customer data, it's not enough to know that you've been breached. You want to know how it happened. What techniques did they use? What data did they try to go for? How long have they been poking around in your network? Well, the old way was to go back to the logs and maybe get a general idea of the techniques that they used to breach your perimeter. But with Canary, you don't have to do that. Canary gives you turnkey honeypots ready for you to deploy across your networks so that you can find out what the bad guys are doing before it leads to a breach. Now, Canaries can be set up in under 4 minutes, and with just a few minutes of configuration, they will look identical to a router, a switch, a NAS server, a Linux box, or a Windows server. Attackers can't tell the difference, and that's what makes it so valuable. Canaries don't look vulnerable on your network. They look valuable. They look as if you're trying to hide your most sensitive files, and that's what attracts the black hats. That's what gets the script kiddies salivating. That's what looks most vulnerable on your network. With Canary, you won't get hundreds of alerts like a log file that's going on overload. You just get one high-quality alert when it actually matters. The company behind Canary has been in the security game for nearly 2 decades. They train countless companies, militaries, and governments on how to break into networks, and Thinx uses that experience to build Canary. Instead of a massive upfront cost, Canaries are licensed annually. If your birds break during the year, Thinx will simply replace them. The pricing allows you to easily try a few and then scale up as you want. Some of them have small shops with 2 canaries, and some are large banks having hundreds of them protecting all of their ingress and egress points. Now, Thinx canaries are deployed all over the world, from Iceland to Australia. Some of the biggest names in the Silicon Valley run them, and they love them. And I guarantee that you will, too. Now, if you want to find out what's going on in your network, if you want to be just a little less vulnerable, if you want the power to go back in time and find out exactly what happened to your data, you owe it to yourself to try Canary. Check out canary.tools/twit to get more information or to see them in action. For just $7,500 per year, you get 5 canaries, your own hosted console, upgrade, support, and maintenance for a full year. And just for the audience of Twiat, if you visit canary.tools/twit and enter the promo code TWIT at checkout, you'll get 10% off your canaries for life. We're so sure that you'll love Thinx Canary, but if you're not happy, you can always return your canaries with their 2-month money-back guarantee for a full refund. Visit canary.tools/twit. That's canary.tools/twit. And enter the promo code TWIT at checkout to receive 10% off your canaries for life. And we thank Canary for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Gentlemen, it's time for us to jump straight into the Enterprise Byte. Now, I wanted to do something a little bit different for this because there has been a technology that has been rising. It was on display at the Game Developer Conference. It was on display at the Silicon Valley Comic Con. And it's actually rising. And it's this. It's VR. Now, we have been talking about VR for the longest time, along with AR, as an upcoming technology. It's dazzled us with its potential. We've seen Google try to give us a couple of enterprise-class applications for augmented reality. We've got Microsoft with their HoloLens. And yes, at GDC, VR was the story. VR, the technology, seems to have matured to the point where people can actually build applications that are reliable for the various systems. Now, this particular one, the one that you're seeing, this is the PlayStation VR. So it's designed to be used with a PlayStation 4. Well, it was actually very exciting. This was probably the big story of GDC. This is a $399 headset versus a $599 from the Oculus Rift or a $799 that you get from the HTC Vive. And this works on a PlayStation 4, which is a $300 computer, versus a $1,000 to $2,000 desktop that you would need to run an Oculus Rift or an HTC Vive to the full extent. Oh, this idea was great for several reasons. First of all, the fact that you can now have a low price point into the VR development area. Also, the fact that it's Sony and PlayStation, you know that there's going to be content available for it, both video games and just viewing content. But the really big announcement for me was the availability of a developer kit that seems to make it incredibly easy, not just to make entertainment titles for VR, but business-oriented. Now, Lou, let me throw this over to you first, because Microsoft, of course, has the HoloLens. It's been trying to get us into AR for a while. We had Google Glass, which was AR. Do you see the start of penetration into the enterprise market, or is it still just games?
You know, augmented reality is one of those things that you can definitely transition the normal human interactions of things and into that kind of augmented ways of doing things. I think, you know, think of an architect, think of a repair person, think of those types of things where they can go and, you know, think of somebody going into a data center looking for a bad port, you know, and a switch or so on. I mean, something that can actually show them where things are at. I think these types of things are a little bit better transition than more of like a VR type thing. I think seeing the augmented reality type things is a more common scenario than more of a VR in enterprise world. But, you know, I'm sure that with VR, you could do other things like, for instance, operate crane lifts and do other things, right, that are you're not even there, right? So that to be able to do those types of things. So it all depends on the industry and the application, I think.
Curtis, there's an interesting point to be made here, because I, like Lou, I have long believed in the promise of AR. I thought, okay, VR is for games, and it's great for games, but it's a game. I never saw it as a business, and definitely not an enterprise application. But at the show, at GDC, there were several manufacturers, not Sony, not Samsung, not Oculus, but the those who were building devices for VR worlds, who were really pushing the non-gaming aspect of VR. And actually, there were a few of them who were making the prediction that AR will be a fad and VR is the one that's going to stay around for business applications. I can't really see any applications for that. Are you okay with that analysis?
I'm not sure that I agree with all of the analysis, because I honestly think that augmented reality is going to be very important. I do think that it's likely that there are going to be two separate markets within the enterprise. Let me tell you why. I think that AR is going to be huge in the field, as Lou said, in service and technician positions. I think in manufacturing, blue collar, if you will, is a huge AR marketplace. Virtual reality, I see as more of a white-collar technology in a couple of key areas. One of them, unsurprisingly, is things like training and education. I think you can take someone to a scenario and train them in ways that you can't using any other, say, heads-up display or just flat screens around them. The other one, and this is a little bit more esoteric, comes in the realm of big data analysis. You know, we're getting into an era when the data can be analyzed and information returned from big data that is so complex and so involving that just looking at it on a flat screen doesn't really allow immersion in that data for a human being who needs to make sense of it and take action upon it. So we have two choices. One is to turn all of that analysis and action over to automated systems. Gartner has talked about that. The other is to provide new ways of looking at and experiencing the data. Companies like SAP show demonstrations of this at conferences like Sapphire. And I think that what we're going to see are data scientists making use of virtual reality to really, in a literal way, get inside the information and help tell the stories that information is presenting for their enterprise.
Well, that's spooky, because that's exactly the application that they were talking about. I didn't want to bring it up. I wanted to see if you would naturally go into that. But there was a booth at GDC that was showing a foot controller. And I'm like, okay, why would you need a foot controller? I could see that in games, but they weren't really pushing the game aspect. What they were pushing is they think VR has a unique application in the displaying of complex information. that doesn't lend itself to either a 2D digital overlay or just a lot of screens like you could get in AR. They think VR is necessary because at some point, people who are really looking into data will need a way to drill through and an easy way to look left and right and let the brain do something that a computer can't, which is to make those complex correlations that even the best big data engine can't do. So, Lou, keeping that in mind, if we set that $800 VR setup versus the $3,000 HoloLens from Microsoft or the $500 AR package that you can get from Google, their Project Tango, which is really just a tablet, do you see then the killer application for VR in enterprise?
Yeah, I think Kirst makes a good point. I think this is being able to visualize. I mean, and being able to do dimensional analysis today is tough. I mean, there's analysis cubes and other things, but being able to do it in a visual aspect in a three-dimensional space sometimes can make things more easier for people to do analysis. So I think this is definitely a good application for that. It's tough to say. I mean, it's very soon in the market. I mean, these types of units right now, the Oculus and these other, the PlayStation, they're all, like you said, very gaming-centric. And they have some enterprise-related stuff. But, again, Microsoft HoloLens, although it's $3,000 for the dev unit, we have no idea if they're going to make a consumer version or if they're going to make an enterprise version of this thing. No idea. I have no privy information on that. So I think, it could be that they bring it down to the average end user, or they do make a version of it for more of a commercial use. So who knows? But, again, I think I'm still on the stance that, that type of technology is easier to transition to for a normal human being from a two-dimensional screen than going into the VR aspect, especially an enterprise standpoint. So I'm still kind of moving in that direction.
Right. Gentlemen, let's go ahead and expand the story a little bit because, again, I know there's going to be people who are listening to the story saying, why are we talking about VR when it comes to This Week in Enterprise Tech? Because VR does not sound like an enterprise topic. But Gartner did release some numbers this past quarter talking about wearables in general in 2016. And actually, they were very enlightening. So between 2015 and 2017, VR/AR as a wearable technology has one of the highest growth rates in that entire category. Smartwatches are expected to just over double. Headsets, sport watches, and fitness monitors are supposed to stay flat. Head-worn displays, that includes VR and AR, are expected to increase over 45 times, and only the smart garment category, which encompasses so many things, is expected to grow faster. That's 88 times between 2015 and 2017. So this is definitely, if you were going to put out your famous Gartner growth quadrant, this is your growth quadrant. This is where you want to be. This is where you want to get in early. This is where you want to make your name so that when it comes time to make all those big profits, yours is the one that everyone else is trying to beat. So, Curtis, let me throw over to you. If you are, let's stay with big data. If you are a big data company, is this the time for you to hire VR engineers? Is this the time for you to get all the dev kits to find out if there's a better way to display the data to your customers?
There's an extent to which this is already happening. If you look at the kind of technical staff that big data companies are hiring, and for that matter, large enterprises. Two that are big are, of course, data scientists and user experience engineers. So they already understand the importance of UX or user experience in making sense of all of this information that is being generated from the vast quantities of data that are now being collected. I think it's fascinating. When I talk to the people who are really big into user experience and data science at some of the large companies, Oracle, SAP, companies like that, they all talk about the importance of telling a story with the information, making sense of it in a way that humans can wrap their brains around. So while on the one hand, we're quite correctly talking about non-game uses, I think there is an aspect of the enterprise use where the whole notion of the technology being used for games and the technology being used for data analysis are coming together to enable the data scientists and user experience engineers to tell a rational story around the analysis.
Fantastic. And yeah, I think that's what's going to decide which companies are popular. Not the ones that come out with the tech the fastest, but the ones who are able to integrate them, to wrap it up with the narrative that they're trying to sell when they sell big data analytics. Speaking of big data analytics, that's what our guest is going to be speaking about. If you ever wanted to know how you could fruitfully use big data analytics, how you could break your data out of data lakes, how you could unsilo all the information from your enterprise, you're going to want to stick around because we've got a great guest coming up for you. But before we do that, let's go ahead and thank the sponsor of this week in Enterprise Tech. Now, this sponsor is all about giving you a better interface. This sponsor is all about giving you something that you're actually going to want, because we remember that feeling that we got the first time we saw our corporate internet. Remember back in the 90s, maybe a little earlier than that, when we first saw the promise of having a responsive design, of having all the information we need to do our jobs at our fingertips. It was great, right? But that interface has aged a decade, maybe a decade and a half. And now it doesn't look so great. In fact, now it probably looks downright archaic, which is why we're happy to have Igloo as a sponsor of the Twilight Riot, because they're a corporate internet that you'll actually like. Now, anyone who has worked in that corporate internet environment knows that you need to have your tools at your fingertips, but you also need to make sure that your tools are responsive to the people who are actually using them, that they'll work on the devices that we use on a daily basis, and that they will maintain security throughout the process. Well, that's exactly what Igloo does, and the best part is they figured it out for you. It's a cloud portal that enables you to share files, collaborate on documents, blog updates, coordinate calendars, and manage your projects all from the same attractive and intuitive interface. They leverage the best part of the intranet, which is important, enterprise-specific data at your fingertips, and what people have come to expect from the social internet. Igloo gives you your users' comments, like buttons, and the ability to add content based on permissions with drag-and-drop widgets and a WYSIWYG editor. Of course, that beautiful and intuitive interface isn't very useful if your users can't access it on the devices that they're using, and that's why Igloo was built with a responsive design that automatically reformats to your phone or your tablet. It's also customizable. SharePoint, Salesforce, Active Directory, and soon Dropbox and Box can all live inside your Igloo, branded with your look and feel so that your users don't feel as if they're jumping off your corporate intranet to get to the data that they need. How about that security that I talked about? Well, what about SSL and 256-bit encryption baked into a variety of access, authentication, and identity service modules to ensure that only authorized users have access? Now, they offer plans starting as low as $3 per month per user, and unlike other solutions, you get full access to Igloo's entire suite of tools, all for that one low price. No nickel and diming you to death. Volume pricing is also available, and Igloo is used by government agencies and companies like Hulu, Inventive Health, American Family Insurance, and Ipswich. Here's what we want you to do. We want you to try an intranet you'll actually like. Sign up now and try it for free at igloosoftware.com/twit. That's igloosoftware.com/twit. And when you sign up through our link, you can get your own Igloo for up to 10 people absolutely free for as long as you want. Again, that's igloosoftware.com/twit. And we thank Igloo Software for their support of this week in Enterprise Tech. It's time for my favorite part of every show, and that's when we introduce our guest to bring the next big idea to the table. We're speaking with Dr. Ian Howells from Argyle Data. Doctor, thank you very much for coming on to This Week in Enterprise Tech.
It's great to be here.
Now, you represent Argyle Data. Can you tell us what is Argyle Data?
So we're a blend of people from the mobile carrier space with people with years of experience in, you know, big data and machine learning. We kind of came together with a simple belief. If you look at dramatically more data, and telcos have a lot of data, and you look across more sources, more often using machine learning apps, you can get insights into your data that previously were impossible. And that's the basis for tens of new applications for the mobile telco space. Now, most people will agree with that, but what they don't agree on is where to start. And we did a little lot of research about, you know, what applications should you start with if you get a big data platform. And what became apparent to us is, you know, mobile fraud is a big, big issue. They lose $38 billion worth a year. And one of the nice things is it has a really hard ROI. It's not fluffy. And a byproduct is you create a great data lake of data.
Now, one of the issues anytime we've talked about big data is that people can immediately grasp that there's something good here. There's something new. There's something unique. There's something that could be very advantageous in any sort of business relationship, but it becomes a bit too daunting. When people start describing the scope of what big data means and how it actually compares to the old way of receiving information, it becomes almost academic. So what I like about your approach is you've chosen to do big data, but big data specifically about looking for a type of activity that you'd like to discourage.
Yep.
Now, one of the things that we hear a lot are data lakes and data silos.
Yep.
And we don't want data silos and we do want data lakes. But what does that actually mean? What does it mean if I have a data silo? What does it mean to break my data out of a data silo? And then what does it mean when I've properly created a data lake?
So I'll just give an example, which is a real one from the mobile telco space. If you think about it, when you roam abroad, you have a roaming fee. And people are having these great new packages to say, you know, if you come with me, I'm the best person for roaming. So if you have a $5 cap when you go abroad and you pay for 30 days, you have unlimited usage per day, which kind of seems sensible because people will use you when they go abroad, but they pay for 30 days, and typically they'll only go abroad for 5 days. So, but criminals think differently. You could go across the border, you could buy a SIM in the US, go to Mexico, then you've got unlimited usage for $5 a day. So if somebody suddenly goes abroad and starts calling a premium rate number in Somalia, should you ban them or not? If all you can see is their roaming data, you don't know what to do. But if that user is a corporate user in the US, they've been paying their bill for 5 years, they've extended to use their system, you should probably let them call Somalia because they're probably doing it for good reason. If they bought a SIM and never used it in the US, suddenly gone abroad and start using it for €5 a day and using thousands of dollars worth, you should probably ban them. But that's kind of makes intuitive sense. But you think about what we just said. I had to know their domestic data around their voice usage, their SMS usage, their data usage, and their roaming data usage, and their billing, and their CRM. And that's the concept of a data lake. Instead of having separate systems for each of those, you have one system that goes across all those data silos.
Can we talk a little bit about why you've lasered in on SIM-connected devices? Mm-hmm. I know that's part of the Internet of Things, yeah. IoT 360.
Yeah.
But what is unique about SIM-connected devices that makes it a bit more suitable for the work you're doing?
So you kind of think about, you know, new cars have SIMs in them. And, you know, every BMW has a SIM in it now. And you can't disconnect that from the driver. So you better not suddenly switch off that car when the driver has got a SIM and a family and they're paid on time. So the two things, you need to treat them as a single customer. So the IoT device is part of the billing plan for the customer. And the other thing is, from a perspective, you can have these wonderful new applications like I've lost my keys or I can't remember where my car's parked. The telcos can't afford a brand new infrastructure just for these new applications. So you need one single infrastructure for your existing applications and your new extended applications as well.
All right. Now, we've talked a little bit about this, but our audience gets really unsteady if we don't get into the demo. So
yep.
What I'd like to do is guide us through how you're actually using this data. It's one thing to talk about the academics of it, how yep. it's actually going to work, but how does it look?
So what we've got here is a live system and showing some kind of fraud. And the scenario here, we have to anonymize the data, but it's a Brazilian operator, and its subscribers are being attacked. One of the classic techniques is to set up a premium rate number in Somalia or Cuba, and then you drive traffic there. If nobody calls that number, you make no money. So you need to drive traffic there. And there are two kind of classic techniques. You can either hack a PBX and auto-forward the numbers there. The other one is it's called Wangiri, which is Japanese for one cut and hang up. So if you think, well, if they call 100,000 people with one ring and hang up, about 20% of people call back. That's called a classic Wangiri attack. And international revenue share fraud has grown by 500% in the last 2 years, and it's a $10 billion industry. So what I want to show now is how we can do this and discover, A, one attack, the person doing that, and discover a whole crime ring. So that's what we're going to go through now.
Okay, now this interface is built on top of Hadoop?
Absolutely. It's built on top of Cloudera and for the...
Okay.
We're using Impala and Avram Parquet for the kind of Hadoop guys amongst you.
All right, run us through it.
Cool. So let's go. So this is a Brazilian subscriber, and suddenly I've got an alert. I can get through email. I can get through a dashboard. But suddenly I want to do a big view of what's going on, and I'm told there's a Wangiri attack. There's a Cuban operator that's calling my subscribers in Brazil excessively, basically with one ring and hang up. I go to the Wangiri tab. And I can see, yeah, there's this one kind of number that's excessively calling people in my country. So I want to kind of drill down now. And it was kind of interesting we talked about virtual reality. So what we're going to do now is virtual reality was kind of interesting because I think that one of the first kind of things around virtual reality is graphs. So how do I look at relationships in a kind of a graph-based sense. So what I'm going to do now is, because I'm sniffing in live packets, I'm going to put a number in. And it's going to dynamically look up that number. And what we're really looking at here is the raw packet data streaming into Hadoop from the phones, the SMS, the data. And it will pick up the basic number now, and we're going to bring that up. I'm going to select it. And I'm going to look at it in a kind of a different kind of way. So this is where single number is calling large numbers of people, and certain people have called back, and certain people are yet to call back. My goal is to protect the subscribers who've yet to call back. So what we can see here is this is kind of graph,
John,
which is kind of a precursor to virtual reality. I can see here there's this one number here. It's calling hundreds of thousands of people, and blue is a call out, and red is a call back.
How are you getting this data?
We're doing live querying. This is really hard to do at this kind of scale. To do graph queries, you normally expect this to be minutes, and we're doing it interactively. So as I can see here, what's interesting is these people here are the victims who've called back, and we can even drill in and look at their number. These people are the people who've yet to call back. And what's interesting is this is the criminal in the middle. If I switch him off, his colleagues will just continue. So I've got to discover not just the individual crime, but the whole crime ring. So what I'm going to do now is we kind of jokingly call this LinkedIn for criminals, where you have 3 degrees of separation. So just like with LinkedIn, I can look at people I know and people they know. I'm going to look at how criminals interact with each other. And again, this what we're going to do is look at in really just under a minute, we're going to see a whole crime ring appear on the screen. And this is using kind of graph theory, which again, I think is a precursor to doing this through virtual reality. So what we're going to see now is that this guy is not just working by himself. He's working with two other people in different countries.
And I think this is actually our Wi-Fi. There we go.
Here we go. It's coming up. I always laugh here when it says the graph has more than 6,000 elements. There are millions of elements here. And we're going to very quickly see when it's pulling together the sense of gravity, who the criminals are. And this, again, is a real attack that we saw, and we're just anonymizing it. So here, what I've been able to do is to go from one single number to see that this guy is working in a gang of three. This is the guy we originally started with. This is his accomplice that's working at a key. And then there's a minor accomplice here. If we drill in on this guy here, we zoom in.
So, yeah, so what's that cluster in the middle that connects them?
I'll come to that in a second. This is a guy. You can see he's out of Cuba. He's doing thousands of calls. This is a more minor accomplice. If we zoom in down here, it's calling out of Peru. Let's go to those three things you saw. This is cool. Every good software developer before you deploy does a test with test data. So before you're going to call Brazil 100,000 times, you want a test number in Brazil. So these were the test numbers they were actually using. And you think about crime as a service, you can rent these test numbers. So these have been called in Brazil 5 times. This one's been called 4 times. This one's been called 4 times as well. So they've shared those test numbers. And what's kind of interesting is now I want to ban the three criminals but not ban these test numbers. Because if I know these are test numbers for Wangiri attacks, if they're ever used in the future, I can predict an attack is going to be happening. So now I know instantly I'm going to basically switch off these three players but not these numbers.
So quick question. When you have a graph like this, I mean, obviously this is impressive because anytime you get a visualization like this, immediately it makes it simple to say, oh, yeah, okay, these are attacks. This is how it looks like. This is the circle of influence. How much of this data do you immediately say, okay, these numbers, these actors need to be banned from ever interacting with us? And how many of them are innocent victims that could be compromised and later be used to attack?
So it's kind of interesting. So you look at what we're seeing here. You're really looking at a very high-quality analysis. So it's pretty rare that anything's wrong. Now, criminals share data. So one of the things we kind of saw, the traditional way that people try and protect themselves, let's make the numbers easy. So they have a threshold of, if Cuba calls more than 1,000 times a day to this small country, they're kind of attacking us with a Wangiri attack. And what we saw was it was kind of uncanny. The criminals knew it was 1,000. They were calling 990 times, 992 times, 994 times. Then they called 20,000 times when they attacked. And they knew that there was a backlog in the call center. So if they were the 20,000th in the first attack, they had weeks to do whatever they liked, because they would just overwhelm the call center with bad data. So machine learning really removes that kind of bad data, so you don't get people wasting their time going through false positive after false positive after false positive. So let's just go back to this one guy, this guy in Brazil, because this guy's attacking Brazil. If you're already going to attack Brazil, you've got to monetize it with a local accomplice. So this guy's called hundreds of thousands of people. Who's the person working with in Brazil? So what we're going to do now is we're going to go back to this the original graph. And what I'm going to do is, out of all these people, try and find out who's he having a conversation with locally. So I'm going to filter it. I'm going to do level one analytics and say, okay, with Wangiri attacks, you tend to call once or twice to try and get them to call back. Who's called more than five times? And who's he actually had conversations with rather than these one ring attacks? So we can look at 600 seconds. Suddenly, I can see there's one obvious local accomplice. He's in Brazil. And they've had an hour-long conversation. So really, from one single number,
right.
I've gone to a gang of three across multinational boundaries to the local accomplice in Brazil, which is how they monitor it, monetize it. And this is really the power of machine learning and graph coming together. And I think virtual reality is going to be kind of graph on steroids.
Right, and exactly. It's sort of like the idea is not to see just where the attacks are happening, but to see what the attacks are attached to.
Absolutely, because if you just, it's like guacamole. If you kind of stop one, another one will pop up. You need to be able to visualize all of them and not them simultaneously. And they're not the test numbers. Use them, save them for later, and share them with other people as well.
Okay, so Dr. I have to ask you about this. This is great for me to find out where attacks are coming from. Mm. This is great for when I need to do forensic analysis of what happens, the postmortem.
Yep.
But the promise of big data, and I think the promise of a system like this, is that it will help me fight future fraud. In fact, I think you have a book themed like that. Fighting Future Fraud? That was you, yes?
That's right. Absolutely. Yeah, it was kind of interesting. When you look at the fraud space, it's kind of the good news, bad news. It's gone down from $46 billion to $38 billion. You think, great news. 80% of people believe it's going up. And the reason for that is they know the criminals are getting smarter and the existing systems can't detect the fraud they're being attacked with.
Right.
So they believe that there is invisible fraud or arbitrage. And that's what machine learning can do. It can detect anomalies that are impossible for humans to look for.
Okay, so give me an example. What is your big data tool going to be able to find that I wouldn't be able to find by just saying, oh, this guy calls 20,000 people. Obviously, he's an attacker.
So there was one actual attack, which was it's kind of not fraud, which is why a fraud system can't detect it. So we think about if I want to become the roaming carrier of choice, I'm going to say, you come with me, you know, because people traditionally have said, I go abroad, roaming's so expensive, I switch my phone on, make a call, switch it off. How about you should leave it on all the time because there's going to be a cap per day. So if there's a $5 cap per day when you roam abroad, business people will start using you. But criminals think differently. And this is what we can discover is an individual thing, right, for $5 a day, I can go abroad, I can call whatever I like for $5 a day, and it's called negative margin. So I can get $100 a day of usage for $5 a day. Criminals, however, could think, I'm going to buy 500 SIMs, never use them in the country where I bought them, go abroad, put them in a SIM box, and then I can have basically an exchange where I can call foreign numbers and people can come in and buy by the hour.
Mm.
Now, that's not fraud. That's abuse of the terms of service. We discover that. We light up like a Christmas tree, whereas other systems don't because it's strictly not fraud.
Now, that's scary because when we think of fighting fraud, we think of, okay, you're fighting the people who are slamming you. You're fighting the people who are obviously trying to scam your employees, get credentials that they shouldn't have. But you bring up another part, which is, well, what if the fraud's not illegal? It's just not acting in the right way.
Absolutely. So what you're really doing is abusing the terms of service.
Yeah.
And that's the critical thing around anomaly detection is things that are strange stick out like a sore thumb. Even if you're not looking for them, rules look for things you've seen before. By definition, that's what a rule is. And machine learning, when it looks for anomalies, is able to do, it kind of discovers things that you're not looking for. We kind of jokingly say there's a famous phrase by Donald Rumsfeld, there are the known knowns. That's the things you know you're looking
that's
for.
Right.
There are the known unknowns, which are things that you kind of suspect, but you don't know how to code them. Then there are the unknown unknowns, which you have no clue about. And that's what machine learning, specifically modern anomaly detection, detects.
Right. Oh, and by the way, Green Bits in the chat room is pointing out that your book is available for download from the Argyle data site. So do you want to give people a tease as to why they should download right now and make this their evening reading?
So this really looks at an example of using Hadoop, like kind of Cloudera as an example, and machine learning. And it looks at A, the fraud market, B, the traditional way of doing it, B, the concept of what a data lake is and machine learning as an application against it, then kind of a playbook on how to detect fraud.
I want to bring in my co-host here because I know they've been waiting to comment about this, especially Curtis. Curtis is a big fan of big data. He especially loves Hadoop. I don't know if we still have the Hadoop picture, but Curtis, this is probably the most clear example of big data analytics we've had for a while. We had Splunk on, and they showed us okay, a decent use of logs to look for anomalous activity. But whenever you have an example that's specifically fighting fraud using analysis that can't come from the human brain, that I really like. What do you think?
Well, as you say, this is the sort of thing where the patterns, when you look at all of that data, enable us to have real-time action against fraud in ways that just weren't possible before. It's one thing to say fraud occurred last month. So on your last billing cycle, we found fraud. It's something else entirely to be able to say fraud occurred 10 minutes ago, because the useful action that you can take on each of those examples is much different. So yeah, I think this is exactly the sort of thing that we're talking about when we talk about big data. And this sort of thing also transfers to issues like epidemiology, various sorts of public safety and public service, as well as economics, when you're looking at the actions of thousands upon thousands of customers across a broad geography.
You know, Doctor, it's interesting that your solution reminds me a little of a presentation I heard at Black Hat last year. There's a Bay Area company that they do phone analysis, phone mm-hmm. system analysis, looking for fraud. And one of the things that they were able to discover, again, using big data analytics, was there was always a precursor to a massive attack. And they were able to isolate what a test attack looks like. You would typically, yep. Yeah, exactly. You would have some SIMs that pop up, and they test a couple of systems, and then they'll back off for a day or two, maybe do it one more time, mm-hmm. and then you see the major slam. Yep. And they were able to use that predictive analysis to say, we can tell our clients not just when they're going to get hit, but we can tell them how they're going to get hit.
You know what's fascinating about this is when you're doing predictive analytics is it's kind of different to what Amazon does. Because if I'm buying a book, I want to give you good information to say, recommend good books to me. But in this case, they're proactively lying to you, which would break traditional predictive analytics. We call it adversarial and machine learning, which is how can I predict you're going to, commit fraud when you're actively lying to me to pretend you're not? And the machine learning is subtly different. What you have are specific features that are very difficult for a criminal to work around or very expensive. So what you're already trying to do is to make it economically just not worth their while to attack you or already attack somebody else.
Lou, I want to bring you into the conversation because, and I, again, don't say anything that can get you in trouble, because I understand this is your bread and butter, but you are at the Dynamics division of Microsoft, and they do CRM. They do one of the most popular CRM software suites on the market today. And what I've started to hear is some of the big players are moving more and more, not in just a predictive analysis of customer activity, but also predictive analysis of attack activity. Have you heard anything around the hushed halls of Redmond?
So I do know, I can tell you what actually has been released already. So some of the things that we've released in Dynamics CRM 2016 is adding the capability of machine learning to your organization. So it adds some additional features around analysis of your organization's data, whether it be customer data or so on, and gives you the capabilities of what Azure ML offers to you. So I think this is just the beginning of that. I mean, predictive analytics and relationship intelligence and these types of things are things that all Salesforce and all these different companies, SAP and Siebel and Microsoft, are looking to do in the world of CRM. And I think it just proves, I think Curtis gave great examples. One was that he gave fraud analysis, but it could also be, based off of a bunch of people call in customer service and they're having the same issue, generating this information and even generating bugs for the dev org that, based off of customer analysis and usage patterns and so on and so forth, without even having to call into support, telemetry data and so on. So these types of things are going to be influential and how the businesses will change based off of these types of insights.
And Dr. Howells, we've got a really good question from the chat room from Specs, and he wants to know about bias. And any data scientist will always be very careful about if the data is inherently biased. Is it more difficult to bias data when you're dealing with big data because you've got so many disparate sources of information? Or is it easier to bias the information?
So when we talk about bias, it's kind of interesting. One of the things we learned was, if you think about if you have an outcome, which is this is fraud, this is not fraud, or if you think about CRM is this deal closed, this deal didn't close, you think it would be supervised machine learning. That's what you come to expect. Whereas that kind of works with a CRM system when you have one in three is going to be closed or not. But if it's one in 20 million, it doesn't work. So you have to have unsupervised machine learning, which is how you get the lack of bias. And the other kind of lack of bias is models get stale. So, you know, what you don't want to have is an out-of-date model. And then they used to call it the champion challenger. So you had your current model and you had a parallel system with a challenger model. And then when that got better, you flipped them over. If you have enough compute, you continually, for a simple example, is you always recalculate the mean continually. Every single time you do the calculation, rather than use the mean from the last model. That's how you remove the bias. And you have to have phenomenal amounts of compute to do that. You just couldn't do that 5 years ago. That's so you had to have the average from last month and then continually reuse that every day. We recalculate to remove bias every second.
Dr. Howells, as Lou said, that this is not the end. This is the beginning of this revolution where we're starting to come down from the ivory tower and we actually have useful in real world demonstrations of big data analysis and predictive analysis. So if this is the beginning, where do you go next? Where does your research go next? Obviously, the Internet of Things is huge, and it's now getting us data points that we never thought we would have. Obviously, more and more information is becoming available for purchase for you to put into these big data analytics tools. Where would you want to see your research head in the next 3 years?
So I think that you can kind of, there's a parallel we can look at in the past, is the 80s was about a better way to manage data through relational databases. And then people wrote applications in the 90s using Oracle. They didn't know SQL. So Hadoop is a fundamentally better way to manage massive amounts of data. And the future should be about applications that people can use that can't even spell the word Hadoop, can't even spell the word machine learning. So how do we make machine learning simple for millions of people to use rather than one data scientist in an organization? So I think that's what we need to strive for. How do we just make these applications better? And the people don't need to know the fact that there's machine learning underneath it. That means that you're making it accessible to thousands of people rather than the odd data scientist.
Right. I like that idea of putting machine learning underneath without even having to make that layer transparent. Yeah. Curtis, let me bring you back in here. It seems to me as if naturally, again, we're at that point where we're like, okay, yeah, every business is going to have to do this. Every enterprise is going to have to take advantage of big data analytics. But as you stare into your crystal ball and as you recall the experience that you've had with Information Week Radio, do you see Hadoop starting to take over for Oracle? Do you start to see Hadoop become the chosen analytics tool versus some of the commercial packages that we have out today?
I think that Hadoop and the structured databases are going to live in parallel universes for a long, long time because they really do different things. If you're doing OLTP, online transaction processing, I wouldn't want to put together a Hadoop system to handle all of the transactions coming in from a large bank ATM system or from Walmart's cash registers, their point-of-sale machines. To analyze the data, sure. And I think what we're going to see is more and more connectors between the standard structured data databases and unstructured databases like Hadoop. As a matter of fact, SAP has spent quite a lot of effort doing that, and I'm sure that Oracle is doing the same. So I don't think it's one or the other. What we're seeing is the growth of a parallel universe where we have two different systems that are going to be used for different aspects. We have Hadoop able to offer something that really just wasn't possible through the traditional, SQL databases. To me, the more interesting question is whether for the vast majority of enterprises, Hadoop is going to be something that they build for themselves, or whether we start to see analysis as a service offered on a bigger basis. We're already seeing that in specific industries, things like agriculture. There are some very large analysis as a service bureaus out there. I think that's one of those areas where we're going to see some real growth over the next 5 to 10 years.
All right. Thank you. Lou, do you want to give some last words on this? I mean, not giving away anything that Microsoft might have on the back burner here, but I think you can offer us a unique perspective on the future of predictive analytics.
Absolutely. So I think Curtis hit it right on the nose is a lot of organizations are, especially for perf reasons too, are using data warehouses, you know, and moving data to other places like Hadoop and so on to do the analysis outside, out of band type of analysis, where they're replicating the data at transactional time to these other places so you get real-time capabilities. And I think that's a lot of same patterns that a lot of organizations are doing, especially even the financial institutions. So I think this is a pattern that you'll see consistently across the board where relationship, type SQL type relationship databases will still kind of still be prominent in that area because of the way that you can design a system using relational versus a kind of a non-structured database. But in the same sense, you'll see a lot of cloud-born applications that go to these NoSQL and these other types of database systems directly because they are built for the cloud and they're not necessarily built for transactional needs. So I think it all depends on application here. But again, some of the traditional legacy type applications that still use relational databases, they're going to be moving to this kind of like hybrid heterogeneous type environment. I think you'll see a lot of cloud services and other things that are going to be offered for kind of both scenarios. But in the same sense, big data in general is just tough. And to be able to do analytics and real-time analysis is something that all enterprises are going to need going forward. So I think you'll start to see kind of the breakthrough in both industries and in both scenarios.
Fantastic. And Dr. Howells, you get the last word here. If you're sending our audience home, what would you like them to know about predictive analysis? What would you like them to know about big data? What would you like them to carry back to their CTOs and CIOs and say, this is the way we should be proceeding?
So I think the core thing is when you look at predictive analytics, it runs against the raw data set. So it's not like pre-filtered per store, as Curtis was saying. You get the raw data set, and then it should be a service where machine learning is performed against the raw data set to make it easy enough for anybody to use. And there's a subtlety is machine learning and analytics are subtly different. Is machine learning can identify what you need to look at, then you use analytics to actually analyze it, and it makes it possible to analyze much less data. Than without machine learning. So you're really running, you're doing things that would be impossible, would take a human years to do in seconds, but then you still have analysis afterwards. So you don't go from a team of 64 analysts to zero, you go from a team of 64 analysts to two. And they're doing really high value, really high IQ kind of work, and they're doing analytics on post-process machine learning results.
Dr. Ian Howells with Argyle Data, we want to thank you so very much for being on This Week in Enterprise Tech. This, again, anytime we can have someone come in, a guest, and show us an actual use of big data analytics rather than just the promise, it's always a special time. Thank you so very much for coming.
Great being
for making the trip to be actually in the studio. We have to get you on an episode along with Splunk and just we'll big data it up.
Yeah, absolutely. Sounds great. So what we're looking at here is the SS7 network versus IP.
Right.
So, yeah.
Now, if they wanted to find out more about Argyle Data, if they wanted to find out more about your work, if they wanted to find out where they could get a copy of your book, where should they go?
It's two places. The website for Argyle Data is www.argyledata.com. And then we also have a website called Fraud Tech Wire, which just talks about the mobile industry and big data usage and machine learning usage and fraud within the mobile industry. And that's where the book's available, which is really looking at how you can predict future fraud and detect it using machine learning. So, again, that's fraudtechwire.com.
Again, that's Dr. Ian Howells with Argyle Data, and we thank him for being part of the Twiat Riot. Gentlemen, I also want to thank you. You know I don't want to do this show without not just my colleagues, but my friends. Let's start with you, Lou, because Chibert's not here and he's not hogging up the spotlight this time. Where can people find you? Where can people find your work? Where can people go and support Dynamics?
Absolutely. So you can always find me at Lumen on Twitter. And of course, there's check out Dynamics CRM 2016, just released recently, and a lot of new extensions and capabilities there. And like I said, you know, this machine learning integration, and of course a lot of stuff around my personal app we helped build is the integration inside of your Microsoft Outlook or OWA application. We have a CRM app for Outlook that we built, and you can go there and integrates directly with Dynamics CRM and so on. So check that out. And that could be found at crm.dynamics.com.
That's Lou Maresca, who's also famous for having a little Maresca in the house right now. Lou, always a pleasure. We'll have you back again real soon.
Thanks for having me.
And Curtis Franklin. We were having dinner the other night in Orlando, and it made me realize how much I enjoy having you as a friend and how much I really enjoy being able to talk to you each and every single week on This Week in Enterprise Tech. Could you please tell the good folks at home what they could expect from Information Week Radio in the coming week?
Well, Padre, the feeling is mutual. This is one of the highlights of my week. And I tell you, the thing that we're working on most is bringing the stories of CIOs and IT executives to people through the radio shows that we're doing around the Information Week Elite 100 finalists. These are the companies that have done the most innovative work over the past year. Their projects are just incredible. And what we're talking about is not only how they did the work, but the impact that work had on their teams and their organizations. So we'd love it if people would listen to those. Come on over to informationweek.com for all of that information. Plus, get ready for the Information Week Elite 100 conference, which happens the first week of May concurrent with Interop.
Curtis, Lou, Dr. Hulls, thank you very much. And thank you again for making the show a lot of fun. Folks, we also want to thank you, the person who watches each and every single week or listens to us on your drive to work. We wouldn't have a chance to do the show without a loyal, loyal audience. We want to make sure that you can get all the episodes that you want and that you can get the service that you want from This Week in Enterprise Tech. And you can find that at our show page at twit.tv/twiet. If you go there, not only will you find all the back episodes of This Week in Enterprise Tech, along with the links to the stories that we talked about in each show, but you'll see a little drop-down menu so you can get the format of your choice, be it audio, video, or high-definition video, delivered into your device of choice. We want to make sure that you can watch the show or listen to the show the way that you want to. So again, that's twit.tv/twiet. Also, don't forget that you can follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/PadreSJ. If you find me there and follow me, you'll be able to see what I'm doing each week on the show, as well as suggest guests and topics for future episodes. You also get to see what I do when I'm not in the Twit Brickhouse, which sometimes is kind of weird, sometimes is kind of fun, and sometimes it's just Padre, like, for example, that land tiger that I found, which was, again, very strange. Also, don't forget that we do this show every week on Fridays, 1:30 p.m. Pacific time. If you go to live.twit.tv, you can watch the live stream, the pre-show, the post-show, and everything in between. And as long as you're watching live, why not jump into our chat room at irc.twit.tv? There you'll meet people like Specs and Eric Duckman and Lou MM and Keith512, the people who make chat room and chat room what it is. Again, irc.twit.tv, and go ahead and participate in the experience that is Twit TV. Finally, I want to thank everyone who makes this show possible here in the Brick House. That's Lisa and Leo, who let us do This Week in Enterprise Tech. That's Carson, my super producer. And that is, this week, my temporary TD, since everyone else is sick, John Slanina, who did a bang-up job. John, I don't know if you're on mic, if you want to talk, but if you could just say hello to the people at home and let them know that Jammer B is with us.
Hello!
There you go. Folks, if you want to support Jammer B, just buy an album of Upfries McGee, right? That's the one that they want.
Humphreys McGee.
Humphreys McGee. There you go. Until next time, I'm Father Robert Ballester, the Digital Jesuit, just reminding you, if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep quiet.